It took a bit of fumbling, but I finally felt the bra separate and come undone. I had to stop kissing her and look. There was no way I could stop myself. She just grinned as I stared down at her breasts, then leaned in and whispered in my ear, "Touch them." I ran my fingers over her soft skin, cupping her breasts in my hands, feeling the firm points of her nipples. She murmured as I brushed my thumbs over them, caressing them, making them even harder. I did that for several minutes, just luxuriating and touching her, amazed that I was finally doing something I dreamt about for so long. Then I bent my head down, put my mouth on her nipple, and began to lick her. She arched her head back with a guttural noise of desire. Our hands moved feverishly over each other's bodies, mine running up and down her chest, hers clutching my hair and gripping my back. Finally, I came up for air and we kissed again. 30 seconds later, she was hastily trying to pull off my clothes. We fell backwards on the bed, and she shucked off her boots and shrugged her way out of her thong. I yanked my own boots off, but I didn't get much farther than that because I couldn't stop watching her. I just kept thinking, this is really going to happen. This is really going to happen. Once she was naked, I moved my head down between her thighs, but she put her hand against my shoulder and stopped me. When I looked up, she grinned and shook her head no. "This time," she purred, "I get to do it." She pushed me gently onto my back, hastily unbuckled my belt, and pulled my pants completely off. Needless to say, I was already rock hard. She settled her body down between my legs, and I could feel the full weight of her breasts on my thighs as she brought her lips close to my throbbing shaft. She kissed it, tickled it with her breath, brushed her face against it adoringly. She circled it with her hands, pulled it up straight from my body at a 90-degree angle, and then began to lick it up and down like an ice cream cone. I groaned in pleasure. After a minute of that, she scooted her body around so that she could continue at a more natural angle. She pressed her body against mine, her breasts against my stomach, her hips right next to my head, and took me completely in her mouth. I groaned and grasped her ass, just kneading her soft, firm cheeks with one hand as she began to suck. At first, she just lolled her tongue around the head, but gradually she began to move up and down on me, taking me inch by inch between her deliciously soft, wet lips, until I was all the way inside her mouth. I lay there on the bed groaning, lost in ecstasy. As good as she'd been with her hands a couple of days before, she was even better with her mouth, but she never let me get too close to coming. It was like she had a sixth sense about how close I was. She would go fast and furious for a while, building right up to the peak of orgasm, and then slowly ease off and gradually stop altogether. She might give me a kiss or a lick every few seconds, but she would let me cool off before taking me all the way to the brink again. I was just lying there lost in a haze of bliss when something brushed my face. I opened my eyes, alarmed, and then realized it was her wings. They were still folded together tightly on her back. I'd never been with a woman with wings on her back before, obviously, so naturally I reached out in curiosity. When I touched them, they were soft like silk, but warm. I began to stroke them up and down, just for my own pleasure. "Goddess," she groaned from down in my lap, the word obscured because of what she had in her mouth. "You like that?" I asked, amazed. She nodded, and I felt her lips leave my shaft so she could speak clearly.
"No one's ever done that before."
I began to think of all the other things that no one had ever done for her before, all the things they had ignored because they were only interested in their own pleasure. As she went down on me again, I continued to stroke her wings, and she unfolded them out to their full span. I caressed the thin skin, felt the strong muscles where the wings connected to her back, and gradually worked my way down her spine to her tail. I began to stroke it with my fingertips, circle it with my hand, and slowly follow it from the base all the way down to the tip of her tail. Every time I touched her someplace new, she moaned the way most women would if you went down on them. Which gave me an idea. I grabbed her legs and forcibly shifted her body over on top of me. "What are you?" she started to say. But when her lap was in my face and I began to lick between her legs, she figured it out.
"Goddess!"
she cried out, then quickly put me back in her mouth again. We continued that way for several minutes, me in absolute heaven, getting sucked while my tongue alternated between being inside her and licking her clit. At the same time, I let my hands rove over her smooth back, her dainty waist, her absolutely magnificent ass, even stroking her tail or caressing her wings. I could tell she was getting close to coming. Her thighs began to tremble, and she was beginning to make sharper, more high-pitched noises, when suddenly she broke off and rolled away from me.
"Why did you do that?"
I asked in bewilderment.
"Because I'm getting close to coming," she gasped.
I groaned in frustration.
"Please don't tell me you're stopping in the middle again."
"No,"
she laughed as she spread out her wings and lay down on her back. Then she grabbed my arm and pulled me insistently towards her.
"When I come, I want you inside me."
Holy shit. No woman had ever said anything that hot to me in my entire life. I moved on top of her body and positioned myself between her legs, feeling the warmth of her belly against mine. I have to admit, I was a little nervous. She'd had me on the edge of ecstasy for a very long time.
"I don't know how long I'm going to last," I whispered. "I mean, I'll try to."
"Shh," she whispered, pressing a finger against my lips.
"I don't care. I just need you inside me."
I almost came just from hearing her say that. I breathed heavily and stared into her eyes as I moved between her legs. As my tip pressed between her lips, her face took on a look of blissed-out surprise. Her eyes rolled back in her head as she began to moan. I was wet and she was soaking. Even though she was tight, it was easy for me to ease inside her. It was probably the single most pleasurable moment of my entire life. No matter how good she was with her mouth, no matter how much she had teased me with her hands, none of that compared with being inside her. I gasped as I slid all the way in, and then suddenly felt her body arch against me. She began to moan louder and more insistently, and I could feel her squeezing my shaft, contracting around me in tiny pulses. I knew I only had a few seconds, so I was going to make them count. I began to thrust inside her, building up faster, as my own pleasure increased tenfold. She dug her fingers into my back and screamed,
"Goddess! Oh, goddess!"
I couldn't hold on.
"I'm going to come. Come inside me. Come inside me."
Then I felt her hands grab my ass and pull me deeper inside her. Oh my God. I groaned as I burst inside her. Her screaming doubled in loudness as her body writhed and her tail thrashed between my legs. I collapsed on top of her, panting, groaning, coming down from the biggest high I'd ever experienced in my entire life. I raised my head and looked at her. She was lying there, eyes closed, mouth open in ecstasy. I could still feel her body trembling underneath me, could feel her gripping my shaft every few seconds with tiny pulses that slowly ebbed away into nothing. When she finally opened her eyes, she looked at me like she was in shock. And then she laughed. She raised her head up and kissed me softly on the lips. "Sorry I didn't last very long," I said. "It's just that you're so..." She put her finger to my lips again.
"No need to apologize. That was absolute heaven. And you're going to be doing a lot more of it the rest of the night."
Oh my God. Dreams really do come true. 39. Afterwards, she lay in my arms, her head nestled on my chest. All I could do was stare up at the vaulted ceilings in shock and just whisper, "Wow." She lifted her head and smiled.
"I'm assuming that's a good sign."
"That was a religious experience," I murmured. She laughed as she traced her fingers down my chest.
Don't go talking about religion. Didn't you hear? It's a turnoff to succubi.
Well, then let's not ever talk about religion again, I said, and kissed her.
After about 10 seconds, she pulled away and looked into my eyes.
Would you do something for me?
Sure, I said. Anything. What do you want?
I want you to do what you did to me in the inn,
she whispered shyly. I grinned. I thought that's what we were doing before we had sex.
That was incredible, but I want you to do that thing you did, where you licked me and your fingers were inside me. All I want to do is concentrate on feeling that.
I looked at her in confusion. I thought you didn't like it. I thought that's why you pushed me away.
No, you did everything right,
she purred, and she pressed her entire body against me. And why did you stop me?
Because you were about to make me come.
I raised my eyebrows. Usually that's a good thing.
Normally it is,
she laughed, then grew shy again.
But I was afraid.
Why?
Succubi have sex for many reasons. One is to drain the life energy of men. Another is because we're forced to by our masters. The third, very rare, is for our own pleasure, independent of anything else other than just enjoying ourselves. The thing is, whomever we're with usually treats us like objects. We're everything they've ever fantasized about, and so they use us without any regard for our own pleasure.
I winced. Did I do that?
No, not at all.
Then she smirked.
Well, in the beginning, when you summoned me, I knew you definitely wanted it like that, which is why I was such a bitch to you.
She winced.
Sorry.
It's okay, I said, twirling her hair absentmindedly between my fingers. You were right. I wasn't thinking about you. I was only thinking about me.
She smiled sweetly, kissed me on the lips, then continued.
No one I've ever been with has given me pleasure without taking even more for themselves.
She paused.
You remember when I was being sarcastic and said you were the best I've ever had?
Yeah, I asked, not exactly sure I wanted to hear the next sentence.
It was the truth,
she said quietly. My heart soared. And I'll admit, my ego went sky high.
Nobody had ever given me that much pleasure, much less done it without asking anything in return. I was a bitch about it afterwards, because I couldn't bear for you to know the truth.
Then she went quiet.
What? I asked.
There's an old succubus tale that says if a man makes you come without coming himself, it gives him a power over you more powerful than any collar.
Is that true?
She smiled seductively.
I think you should make me come a lot more so we can find out.
Oh, God, yes, I murmured.
I put my hand behind her head, drew her in close, and kissed her long and deep.
After a minute, she broke off our kiss and smirked.
So, are you going to do like you promised me?
You do know that I get a tremendous amount of pleasure when I go down on you, right?
She bit her lip, which drove me crazy with desire.
Well, how about we both have a lot more pleasure then?
Absolutely, I grinned as I began to move down her body.
Or we could get some sleep, she teased.
Later, then I teased her back. Or is that what you like? I heard succubi have sex with men while they sleep.
That's the old-fashioned way. Besides, you're not sleeping, and I want to do it again.
I French-kissed her, then slowly moved down her neck and breasts, stopped to lick and suck her nipples on the way. I continued kissing her belly, then down her landing strip of dark, curly hair, until I stopped between her legs. I gave an encore performance of the other night at the inn, with a few variations. This time she came. Multiple times. 40.
We had sex and made love several more times throughout the night. The sex was fast and furious, almost animal in its passion. My favorite position was her on top, watching her thighs bounce up and down on top of my hips as she took me inside her.
I loved watching her breasts move and jiggle as she bobbed up and down, crying out in ecstasy, her tail lashing back and forth like a whip. The lovemaking was slow and gentle, with me on top, staring deep into her eyes as I moved inside her, watching every tiny change of expression on her face as she came. It was the best night of my life. There wasn't another one that even came close. After the fifth time, I fell back in the sheets, completely drained. She nuzzled my chest with her lips and stroked my skin with her fingers.
"Just a quick nap. Then we can do it again," I murmured.
"Of course," she whispered.
"Just sleep."
I looked down at her, tilted up her chin, opened my mouth, and didn't say anything. I wanted to tell her so badly that I loved her, but I was afraid. I was afraid that it might be too much, that I would be ruining the moment, that it would be too needy. So all I did was kiss her on the lips. After I pulled back, my head wearily hit the pillow, and I could feel the whole world going dark around me.
"Sleep," I heard her voice whisper. "Sleep."
41. When I woke in the morning, or whatever passed for morning in this strange, shadowy land, I rolled over in bed and reached for Alaria. She wasn't there. I frowned sleepily and sat up in bed. She wasn't anywhere in the bedroom. I got up, wondering if maybe she'd gone to get food or drink, and that was when I saw the letter on the nightstand next to the bed. My heart seized in fear, but I had to read it. Even if it had meant my death, I would have read it.
"Dearest Ian, so, I guess the seven hells froze over. That was a joke. Sometimes you have to laugh or you'll cry. You're sleeping right now as I write this. I want nothing more than to crawl back in bed with you, but I can't. Please don't be angry with me. I know this must be painful for you to read this, but it is horribly painful for me to write it. Do you remember last night when I said the reason I didn't let you make me come at the inn was because I was afraid? Afraid that you giving me one-sided pleasure would give you a hold on me? One more powerful than any slave collar? That was only half the truth. I was afraid, actually. But I found out last night that the old succubus tale wasn't true. But what I found out instead was that my feelings for you absolutely could enslave me again. If I remained here, you would have a greater hold on me than any master I've ever known. As pleasurable and as powerful as last night was for me, I can't stay just for that. Not now. For the first time in my entire existence, I am free. Free to do whatever I want. You have no idea the magnitude of the gift you have given me. Something I never thought I would ever have. And you gave it to me freely, without an expectation of reward or sex or anything. I have never experienced that before, and it touched me to my soul. I am leaving now to go kill my other seven ex-masters, and I must do it alone. I need to go on my own quest, something I can do as an adventurer in my own right. I know you would come with me if I asked, and that is why I can't. Someday we will meet again, after my travels are done, and I have taken my final vengeance. I hope to return to you just as I left you, so that you'll wake up with me next to you like I never left. I want you to know that I am crying as I write this. Last night was the best night of my life, and I am afraid of what I'm giving up. But I'm terrified that if I stay with you, I will give up something even more precious, my freedom. Please don't be angry with me. Please don't hate me. That's the thing that breaks my heart, that you would hate me for what I'm doing now. I wish you all the happiness in the world. Know that you have given me more in one night, both the pleasure we shared and the gift of my freedom, than I have ever had in all the rest of my life combined.
Beneath that, there was a sentence that was scratched out. Then another sentence below it that was scratched out, then another. Eventually, there was one final paragraph.
I don't know that I'll ever get to say this in person. Hopefully I will, but that's not guaranteed. I tried to write it several times, then stopped myself. But it's important I say it. And I'm free to do it now, no matter how scary it might be. I love you. Alaria.
I fell to the ground, my back pressed against the bed, and stared at the letter. My hands trembled as I read it over and over again. Part of my heart leapt at the words, but for the most part I was crushed. I felt more pain than I ever had before, in the game or real life. My eyes blurred with tears, and I was about to cry, when suddenly I heard the chime of a computer sound effect. It was the chat box. In shock and amazement, I called up the menu and saw there was a message for me. I opened the interface and a message appeared.
Ian, it's John. We finally got everything ironed out. I'm sorry it took so long. We didn't want to just yank you out of the game. We can't actually see what you're experiencing, so we didn't know if you were in the middle of a battle. Are you okay with us bringing you out?
I stared at the message for the longest time. I didn't know what to feel. In the span of just a few hours, I had gone from the heights of ecstasy and even love to the depths of heartbreak, with more pain than I'd ever experienced before. And now, suddenly, I was able to return to my own world, leaving all this behind as though it were just a dream. With trembling hands, I typed on the virtual keyboard. I need a couple hours first. Is that okay? I sent the message, and John responded almost immediately.
Of course, take your time. Just log out whenever you want. We'll be waiting.
Thanks, I typed, and closed the chat box. Then I looked at the letter again, and finally the tears came. 42. I emerged a couple of hours later, fully dressed in a new pair of clothes that had been laid out at my door. Stig was there waiting for me in the antechamber.
Hey, boss.
He peered past me into the bedroom. Then he looked up at me questioningly.
Where's Alaria?
She's gone.
Oh, you sent her off on a mission?
No, she's gone forever. Stig flinched in shock.
What happened?
I gave her her freedom, and she left to go do what she had to do. The imp stared at me.
You gave her her freedom?
I knelt down in front of him so that we were almost at eye level, or as close as we were going to get. Yes. Now I have to go back to... Well, I have to go. But before I do, I want to give you a gift too.
What?
The imp asked, still stunned. I reached out, took the collar from his neck, and willed it to unbind. It snapped in two, and I easily pulled it from his neck, then held it out to him. I wanted to give you your freedom too. The imp looked at me in shock. Then he began to tremble. He reached out slowly for the collar, as though afraid to believe what was happening, as though he might wake up from this dream any second. I took his tiny gray hand and placed the collar in it. It's yours, I said, and smiled sadly. It should have always been yours. The imp looked up at me, and his lower lip trembled.
You're sure?
He asked, his voice full of hope and fear. I'm sure. You're free now. Go and do whatever you want. Live your life. Although, if you could do me one more favor?
Anything,
he said, and I've never heard him more sincere in our entire acquaintance. I handed him a sheaf of papers, the hand-printed instructions I had toiled over the last couple of hours, partly to keep myself from thinking about my heartbreaking. These are instructions for Grok and the others. It's the basic rules on how to create a democratic society. I pulled it from something called the Constitution. Well, what I remember of it from ninth grade, anyway. It's the rough outline of how they can govern themselves. I just...
My voice choked up as I thought of Ilaria. I have to go now. Will you give it to them?
Absolutely, Stig said,
and took the papers from me. I nodded and put out my hand. Stig stared at my hand, then gingerly held out his, and we shook. Sorry I was a dick sometimes, I said. He grinned.
You're human. You can't help yourself.
In spite of myself, I laughed and nodded. I think you're probably right.
You were a good master, though,
he said quietly. Thank you, Stig, I said, and smiled sadly. Thank you for everything.
You too, Ian.
I grinned. It was the first time he'd ever used my name. I stood up and my finger hovered over the logout option. I looked down at Stig. I hope we see each other again someday, I said. He nodded.
Me too.
Goodbye, I whispered. And then he was gone. 43. When I opened my eyes, I was back in the lab. My mouth felt like it was made of cotton. My body ached to the bone, probably from lying in one position too long. But other than that, I felt remarkably good for someone who had just spent the last week in a coma. Well, except for the part where my heart had been smashed into a million little pieces. I raised my head gingerly, and was shocked to see an entire room full of people standing around me, with John Perkins and Nurse Vivian at the front. They all looked terribly concerned, until they saw me lift my head and stare at them. Then they all broke out into smiles, applause, and triumphant hoots. John came over to the bed.
You all right?
Yeah, I think so.
You concerned us a little when you took a couple hours to log out. We thought you would have been raring to get out of there.
I had to set up a new form of democratic government, I muttered.
What?
Nothing.
Can I get a glass of water?
I croaked.
Absolutely.
Vivian gave me a glass of water and I gulped it down. It felt like cool spring rain splashing across the Sahara.
I just want you to know, John said, you were perfectly safe the entire time, although we admittedly had some issues with being able to pull you out.
I sort of guessed, I said dryly.
We tried to monitor everything you saw and felt during the game, but...
My heart froze. I hadn't thought that they would be able to watch my every move, and I hadn't considered that I'd potentially been making a pornographic movie for them last night.
But what? I asked. The thing is, there was a feedback glitch in the monitoring system, so we couldn't see or hear anything.
I don't think I'd ever been so relieved in my entire life. And yet, there was also a feeling of unexplainable loss. All I had left of her were my memories. Not even a picture. Not even the goodbye letter she'd written me.
The upshot is, John continued, we have no idea what happened to you in there. So, what happened?
I stared off into the distance, my heart aching. That line from the poem echoed in my brain. Better to have loved and lost than never loved at all. Everything I'd experienced proved that beyond a shadow of a doubt. I smiled wistfully. I met a girl. 44. It took a few hours to recover, but some chicken broth and lots of water did the trick. Once I regained my strength, I felt amazingly refreshed, as though I'd taken the longest nap in the history of the world. Which I kind of had. Once I was feeling better, the company debriefed me. I told them everything that had happened, although I left out the more intimate details between me and Ilaria. Other than that, though, I covered everything from the time I arrived up through the point where I gave Stig his freedom and exited the game. Everybody in the room listened quietly, even respectfully, except for the bro dude from sales.
Dude, what'd I tell you? You had 6 days at 24 hours a day double time. He hooted. And you got to hang out with a smoking hot chick. Is this the best job in the world or what?
I had to agree with him there. To smooth over any ruffled feelings, the company not only gave me my pay for the full amount of time I'd been in the game, but an extra $10,000 bonus, provided I signed a bunch of forms that absolved them of all liability and promised I wouldn't sue them. I signed them happily and took the check. It would go a long way to fixing my financial situation in the real world. I didn't tell them that even if they had never given me a penny, it would have all been worth it. Everything I'd experienced back there had been priceless. At the end of the debrief, John asked me,
"Would you consider going back in?"
"Into the game?"
"Not just the game, but the long-term system. You're basically our most experienced immersion QC guy at this point, and you came through with flying colors."
I thought of Alaria. John must have misinterpreted the heartbreak on my face because he quickly added,
"I know it's a little early to be asking that, and you probably have a lot to process, so just give it a little time. Sleep on it for a couple of days."
"Do I have to play the same character?"
"No. We can start you off from scratch. Although it would be very helpful if you kept on playing from where you left off."
I thought about all the misery I'd seen, and some of the misery I'd caused. I thought of the plantations, the mines, Stig, and Alaria. My stomach clenched at the thought of ever forcing another demon to wear a collar for me again. "Do I have to play a warlock?" I asked.
"No, not if you don't want to."
I knew they just didn't want me to sue them, so they were being extra accommodating. But I wasn't really sure how I felt about any of it. The pain was still fresh, and part of me never wanted to go back into the game ever again.
"Let me think about it," I said. "Of course. Take a couple of days off and decompress," John smiled. "You've been through a lot."
He had no idea. 45. I spent the next several days just taking it slow. I paid off my landlord, got my life back in order, and then I just started wandering around my neighborhood. It's funny, everywhere I looked, I saw places I'd hung out with my ex-girlfriend Amy. The coffee shop, the park, the corner bar, her favorite restaurant. There were so many places that I associated with her. But where it used to hurt when I saw them before, now I didn't feel anything. No pain. They were just places. Some of them even had really nice memories attached to them. But I didn't have anything to remember Alaria by. That was what killed me. It was like everything I had experienced with her was a dream. Maybe even like she was a dream. The only thing I still had that told me it was real was the ache in my heart. I was at home one night, sort of kind of watching television, when I looked over at my computer system. The rig I had for Otherworld wasn't nearly as advanced as what they'd had back in the lab, but it was enough. Enough to make me feel like I was really there if I chose to go back. I sat there for 5 minutes looking at the system, and then I finally made my decision. I got up, put on the gloves and headset, and lay down on the couch. When I logged on to my account, I saw my hunter, my warrior, and a level 10 warlock named Ian. Holy shit. The company must have linked it with my regular account. I hesitated for a long moment, and then I pressed the button to enter the world. There was a rush of black, and suddenly I was standing in the hallway where I'd left Stig. My imp wasn't there, but someone else was. A cleaning lady who looked like a giant fish. She was walking up the stairs when I reappeared, and she froze in place. Then she started screaming, "He's back! He's back!" as she ran down the steps.
Uh-oh.
I hoped I hadn't stumbled into some sort of counter-revolution or something. As I descended the stairs after her, I came down to the main room, where Grok and a dozen other demons were waiting. As soon as they saw me, they cried out in pleasure and clapped their hands in thunderous applause.
"You returned! We were hoping you would!"
I looked around at them in shock. "Is everything okay?"
"Everything is going splendidly," Grok smiled. "But that's not why we hoped you would return."
Suddenly, from far off in the hallway, a familiar voice croaked,
"Boss! Boss! Boss!"
Stig broke through the forest of demon legs and rushed over to me, a scroll in his hand.
"I wasn't sure if you'd ever come back,"
he wheezed with a giant smile on his face. "Stig, what are you still doing here?"
"No time to talk, boss. This just came in by Raven 2 hours ago."
He handed me the scroll, and I unraveled it. The familiar handwriting pierced my heart as painfully as it had when I saw her first letter. But this time the message was a little different. "Dearest Ian, I think I've made the most horrible mistake of my life. I'm in terrible danger, and I hate to do this, but I am begging for your help. Please come to Kavartos and find Merc in the Netherworld Tavern. He'll know how to find me. If you really do care for me, and if you can forgive me, I need you. More than I've ever needed anyone. Help me, Ian Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope. Alaria."
Every bit of pain in my heart suddenly transformed into joy.
"Good news, boss,"
Stig grinned.
I looked down at him and narrowed my eyes.
"You already read it, didn't you?"
"No, boss,"
he said,
but shook his head yes. I laughed. "Well, I guess I can't blame you. You know where this Kavartos is that she mentioned?"
"Oh, yes."
"Look, I know I set you free, and you don't have to say yes, but would you please?"
"Of course, boss,"
he grinned. I grinned back at him.
"All right, then. Are you ready, Stig?"
"Oh, yes, boss."
"Then lead the way."
This is the end of Book 1, but the story continues with Hell to Pay, Succubus Book 2. Keep listening after the credits for a free preview. If you enjoyed this audiobook, find more just like it by visiting oddfans.com, the premier audiobook discovery service that brings tailored recommendations direct to your email. That's audfans.com. You've been listening to Succubus, Book 1, produced by Emily Durr. Executive producer Greg Lawrence. Written by A.J. Markham. Performed by Iggy Toma, a member of SAG-AFTRA. Text copyright 2018 by A.J. Markham. Production copyright 2018 by Podium Publishing. All rights reserved. 1. At one of the lowest points in my life, the video game gods answered my prayers, and I got a job doing quality control on the biggest virtual reality role-playing game in the world. Think Dungeons & Dragons, but it seems real. Taste, touch, sight, smell, all real. Then things got a little weird. I basically slipped into a coma while inside a long-term immersion unit. It was a new prototype design, so you could game for weeks without needing to eat, sleep, or take bathroom breaks. Spoiler alert, they got me out. But while I was trapped inside the game, I did my job. I played a warlock, basically a magic-wielding sorcerer with the ability to summon demons and force them to fight for me. I helped defeat and kill a murderous priest, a lecherous slave trader, and a demonic overlord. Well, okay, technically, I only chased the slave trader to the demonic overlord, who then killed the slaver himself, but details. I liberated an entire city of demon slaves and basically gave them a Cliff's Notes version of the Constitution so they could govern themselves instead of being enthralled to someone else. And I met a girl. The most beautiful, erotic, playful, and complicated woman I had ever met in my entire life. I fell in love. She left, which devastated me. And then she wrote me asking for my help. And that was how I came to find myself in the grimiest hole-in-the-wall bar imaginable, deep in the bowels of a shithole city called Kavartos. 2. Kavartos was a contested city, meaning all races could mingle peaceably in its streets. However, it was located in orc territory, and I wasn't a high enough level yet to ride a horse, which meant I'd spend the last 4 days on foot, crossing scorching plains of scrub brush and sand, canyons littered with sun-bleached bones, and steppes full of rivers of magma, all while trying to sneak past big green uglies who like wearing 37 enemy skulls as flair on their armor. Some of those skulls didn't have all the skin off them yet either. Ugh.
Besides the orcs, I'd faced down sandworms, viper bats, lizard people, scorpion centaurs, and more. I died 12 times. I'd been resurrected in tiny cemeteries, shallow graves, and mass graves. Waking up inside a mass grave? Not pleasant, let me tell you. I'd finally made my way to Kvartos, which was sort of like a steampunk version of Mos Eisley on Tatooine, except with hundreds of acres of tar paper shack slums and skyscrapers made out of welded-together scrap metal. And by far the nastiest thing I'd experienced so far was the Netherworld Tavern. The place was basically a small cave in a cliff. From the smell, they'd killed the former inhabitant but hadn't bothered to remove it. There were mushrooms literally growing on the floor, lots of them, like a tiny forest. This wasn't an industrial city, mind you, not in some woo-woo druid village out in the swamps. And things were crawling through the mushrooms, millipedes, snakes, lizard rats. I shuddered and tried not to look every time I felt something crawl over my boot. When I said the bar was small, I meant it. The place was basically big enough for 10 people. Which was good, since there were only 6 or 7 in the entire place. A couple of goblin outlaws, a bounty hunter troll, and some really shady characters hiding in the shadows in the back. The bar itself, you know, the part you belly up to, wasn't much more than a piece of planed timber that bore the remnants of 100,000 unwashed forearms and 15 million spilled drinks. If I had scratched it with my fingernail, I could have cut a quarter-inch groove in the gunk on top of the wood. Behind the bar was an orc, a hunched-over old codger missing most of his teeth, but who was just as surly as any other bastard I'd killed in the last 4 days. He used the same rag to dry the drinking glasses that he used to wipe the counters, and occasionally his sweaty face. Unfortunately, I saw him do the face wiping after I'd already finished half my beer. The bottles lining the shelves ranged from earthen jugs to unmarked, chipped bottles, and a couple of leathery sacks that might have been made out of pig's bladders. I decided on principle not to order anything that came out of a bladder. The room was dark, with grotesque memorabilia on the walls. Skulls of various types, fortunately, without any skin on them, rusty scimitars and glaives, and the heads of animals prepared by an incompetent taxidermist. You ever see that meme of the woman who tried to restore a 100-year-old fresco of Jesus, and when she was done, it looked like the Pillsbury Doughboy had been toasted in the oven while wearing a fur parka? Yeah, that was the level of artistic competence on display. There was a wyvern head that looked like Barney's crackhead cousin, and a giant lynx that resembled the Cheshire Cat with crappy veneers. The place looked like the Animaniacs had taken some bad acid and interior decorated the place for Leatherface. I sat at the bar with my faithful imp Stig, who was on his 3rd stein of ale since we'd entered. Stig was a drinker. He might have looked like Yoda's ugly, gray, anorexic cousin with glowing yellow eyes, but he could put away some booze for his size. And after 4 days tromping over dusty wastelands, he wasn't about to be put off by a bit of orc sweat coating his drinkware. Unfortunately, it wasn't just the two of us. A skinny blue demon sat on my right. He had a watermelon-sized head, beady little eyes, and a really strange voice. Kind of breathy, high-pitched, and whiny. Sort of a cross between a squeak and a sigh. There's this documentary called The Mayor of Sunset Strip about a guy in Los Angeles named Rodney Bingenheimer, who was the first DJ in the U.S. to play singles by the Ramones, Van Halen, and the Sex Pistols. Sounds cool as shit, right? Nope. I'm sure he's a great guy, but he has this weird sing-song delivery to his voice that makes him sound like Napoleon Dynamite got castrated. That's what Dorp sounded like. That was his name. Dorp. Least baddest-ass demon name ever.
How did it feel when you stormed the throne room in Abaddon?
My drinking companion asked.
Was it really cool? Did everybody cheer for you? Did they know they were participating in a really historic moment for all demonkind?
No, I said between gritted teeth. We were all just fighting to stay alive.
When it was all over, did they put you up on their shoulders? Did they give you 3 hip hip arrays? Did they name any streets after you?
No, and there was no reason for them to. I said in irritation. They risked their lives. They won their freedom. They deserved it. In fact, they helped me even more than I helped them. Now you may be thinking, Ian, you're an asshole. This demon dorp just really wants to hear about your biggest achievement in the video game so far, that's all. And I totally would have agreed with you back during the first hour. Maybe the first 4 hours even. I was on, hour 96 by this point. Next thing I bet you're going to say is, well, why don't you just walk away, dumbass? That was the problem. I couldn't. Because I had summoned him, and then I had freed him. Which meant I could summon him again if he died. But I couldn't banish him if he annoyed me. And he didn't have to obey anything I told him, like be quiet. Basically, having him there annoying the hell out of me was my own damn fault. Unintended consequences are a bitch. During the Battle of Abaddon, I reached level 10 as a warlock, but hadn't really capitalized on it at the time. Afterwards, I was too busy doing other stuff. Hot sex with a succubus. After Ilaria sent me a letter asking me to come rescue her, I figured I'd better take stock of my abilities. First thing I realized was that I could enslave a new demon to join me in battle. I had slain the requisite number of opponents in Abaddon, and had the necessary 100 souls to forge a new collar. Of course, my plan was to summon the demon, then immediately give it its freedom and the choice of whether it wanted to follow me or not. I was hoping for some badass bruiser with the ability to shoot laser bolts out of his eyes. I wasn't expecting that Pee-wee Herman took a bunch of Quaaludes, had a three-way with Strong Sad and a Smurf, and out popped Dorp. At least he had a somewhat interesting power. He was an illusion demon, which meant he could make other people see things that weren't there. He could even reach into the minds of my enemies to see what terrified them the most, and basically create a lifelike hologram of their worst fears. He'd actually proved invaluable on the trip to Kavartos. He'd saved me and Stig a couple of times when he projected Dvrak, the orcish god of dishonorable death, in front of a bunch of quaking orc warriors, allowing us all to slip out the back. But god damn, he was annoying.
I heard they wanted to make you their king,
Dorp said in his goofy, slow-mo, high-pitched voice.
If they wanted to make you their king, why didn't you let them, boss?
You don't have to call me boss, Dorp.
But Stig does.
Yeah, but Stig does because he's an asshole, I said.
Right, boss,
Stig said, though he shook his head no. So don't be an asshole like Stig.
Okay, master, Dorp,
I sighed with my eyes closed. That's even worse, don't call me that.
Okay, but why wouldn't you be the demon's king in Abaddon?
Because I think everybody should be equal, that's why.
But,
Dorp, let's just drink in silence for a while, okay?
Okay,
he said sadly, sounding like Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh, if Eeyore sucked helium. 5 seconds later,
I think you would have made a great king.
Thank you, I interrupted. But now we're being quiet, right?
Okay.
10 seconds later,
I totally would have fought with you in Abaddon.
I'm sure you would have, but now we're going to be quiet, okay?
Okay.
12 seconds later.
I would have voted for you to be king if they...
Dorp!
Sorry.
15 seconds later.
I totally would have found out Malfuric's weakness and...
I bared my teeth at him like a great white shark.
Sorry.
He murmured, then lapsed back into silence. Maybe this time he would shut up for 20 seconds. Freaking fanboy, I muttered under my breath. Stig overheard.
Fanboy? What's that?
He slurred. It's... How do you explain the concept of a fanboy to someone who doesn't understand the concept of movies, television, or comic books? It's somebody who loves something a whole lot, like... obsessively. Stig frowned.
What's wrong with that?
Well, nothing, exactly. I mean, I'm sort of a fanboy about... I was about to say Star Wars and Otherworld, but stopped myself. Stig leapt in.
Hot chicks?
I laughed. One in particular, yeah.
I'm a fanboy, too,
Stig said, and held up his flagon of booze.
Of this?
No, you're an alcoholic.
What's that?
Somebody who loves alcohol too much.
Oh, I'm an alcoholic,
Stig announced happily to the orc barkeeper.
Good for you,
the orc snarled. Stig looked back at me.
So a fanboy is good, then?
No, it usually means the person's really annoying.
Oh, then you're definitely a fanboy, boss.
Thanks, I snapped.
I'm a fanboy, too, Dorp said. Of you!
Yeah, and I don't want you to be.
But why? You're the greatest warlock who's ever—
Dorp? What did I say about being quiet?
Sorry,
he said sadly. I sighed and turned back to Stig for advice.
What should I do about him? I whispered.
Drink more, boss.
What, does that make it more tolerable?
No, but you get that much closer to passing out, so you don't have to listen to him.
Dorp started talking again.
Boss, I mean, Ian, did I tell you that...
Shink.
A giant blade whizzed out of nowhere and decapitated Dorp. I screamed and jumped back in terror as his head thumped on the bar and stared up at me in shock.
Oh,
Dorp said in that breathy, whiny voice, and then both his head and his body disappeared in a puff of smoke. I looked up to see the old orc wiping a scimitar with his glass cleaning rag. Behind us, the other patrons in the shadows burst into a polite golf clap.
Fanboy,
Stig sneered dismissively at where Dorp's head used to be, then took another drink.
What the hell? I yelled angrily at the orc.
Damned Brotic talks too much,
the orc snarled, and looked at me like, you want some of this too, punk? I stood there at a loss. This guy just murdered my demon. But I didn't really like my demon. And damn, the quiet was nice. Plus, I could summon Dorp again whenever I needed him, which I wasn't going to do until I was basically on death's doorstep. Suddenly, I realized that I could have killed Dorp myself and saved myself 95 hours of annoying prattle. Or I could have at least threatened to do it. That might have bought me a little more peace and quiet. I probably should have killed the old orc, too, on general principle. But I was supposed to get information here about Eloria, and I didn't think it would go over well with management if I started slaughtering their employees.
What should I do? I whispered to Stig.
About what?
Stig asked.
Him killing Dorp.
Tip him double,
Stig advised. The orc chuckled as he put the scimitar back under the bar, the way a bar owner in the real world would hide a shotgun or a Louisville slugger. Then he topped off Stig's drink from a pitcher of what looked like bog water.
On the house.
Tip him triple,
Stig said, and chugged away. Do you know a guy named Merc by any chance? I asked as I took my seat again.
Who's asking?
The orc grumbled. A friend of Eloria's. The orc got a daydreamy grin on his face.
Eloria.
Are you Merc?
Yep,
the orc said, and went back to polishing glasses with the rag, now imbued not only with his sweat, but essence of Dorp, too.
How's my future wife doing?
You. I wasn't really digging on a big green monster having fantasies about my girlfriend, but whatever. Now was not the time to start staking out my domain. She left me a message that said you would know how to find her.
She was in here just a week ago. Said she was going to take down one of her old masters.
500 XP floated up through the air. I'd fulfilled one of the many items taking up my quest list. Merc my words, get information about Eloria's whereabouts. Mark my words. If I ever got to talk to Westex writing staff, we were going to have to discuss their stupid quest titles. That would have to wait, though. I was back in the immersion rig for another week at least, although I'd made them promise to deactivate the video feed as a precondition for my coming back. just in case Ilaria and I celebrated when I found her. Do you know which ex-master she was going after? I asked.
The dread pirate Tarka.
Pirate?
Aye. The scourge of the seven skies.
Skies? Then I remembered. Besides regular maritime transportation, Otherworld sported a steampunk-like assortment of giant airborne ships. Imagine taking an old wooden frigate from the 17th century and slapping a couple of massive hovercraft fans on it. Of course, hovercraft fans constructed with 17th century technology. Still, it was pretty awe-inspiring to see the mammoth ships soaring through the air. I just had no idea that there were actually pirates involved. Made sense, though. If there was shit to be stolen, who cared if it was on land, sea, or air? So, Ilaria's ex-master was a pirate and a warlock?
Oh, yes. In fact, Tarka's entire crew is made up of demonic slaves.
Great, I sighed, then frowned. Wait, how are we gonna get Ilaria if she's on an airship?
I guess you're gonna need a ride.
Do you know anybody who's got a ship? The orc jerked his head towards the back of the bar. I turned around to see a man slouched insouciantly in a booth at the back, his face obscured by shadow.
Go talk to him, Merc said. He's the only one insane enough to do what you want.
A window popped up. When the ship hits the fan, talk to the mysterious stranger about booking passage on his airship. XP 500. Okay, I had to admit, I kind of liked that quest title. I selected accept, slapped down a handful of silver on the bar, then looked over at Stig. He looked right back at me.
Have fun, boss.
You're not coming? I asked, a little surprised.
Nope. I'm a free imp. I'm just gonna sit here and drink.
He slurred, then let out an enormous wet burp. Maybe I'll summon Dorp to keep you company, I said with a mischievous grin. He looked at me out of the corner of his eye.
You wouldn't.
Not if you come with me to hire the pilot. Stig muttered under his breath.
What good is it to be free when you keep getting threatened by Bosch all the time?
Did you just call me an anus and impish? I asked, repeating what Ilaria had told me a week before.
Dirty anus,
Stig corrected me, then slid off his chair and promptly collapsed face first on the mushroom-carpeted floor. You all right down there? Stig didn't bother to lift his head. He just waved me on from the floor.
Go on. I'll catch up,
he slurred. I shook my head, turned around, and headed for the booth. As I drew closer, though, something seemed wrong. The figure's face might have been too dark to see, but something else about him was familiar. The pose, the feathered hair, the white shirt and black vest. And then he leaned forward into the light and gave me that famous grin. Hark, Silo, the guy said. Oh, hell no, I grumbled. It was supposed to be an homage, French for ripoff, to the legendary smuggler, except it looked more like Mr. Bean with Harrison Ford's hair. Couldn't get too close to the real thing if you didn't want to get sued, I guess. 500 XP floated up through the air. That was the only good thing about this situation. The pilot smirked. Chewie here tells me you're looking for a ship. Which made absolutely no sense, since I hadn't talked to anybody but Merc. Who's Chewie? Han So Lame tilted his head towards a mountainous figure in the shadows. I turned to look at it, noting that the height was right for a certain sidekick. Then the creature stepped into the light, and I recoiled in horror. It was like they'd used Nair on a Wookiee, gotten him down to nothing but pink skin and stuck Mr. Bigglesworth's head on him. You know, Dr. Evil's hairless cat from Austin Powers.
Meow,
the abomination mewled. Oh, hell no, I yelled. Look, I'm a Star Wars geek, but I'm not a snob. I'm perfectly fine with poking fun at the movies. You can bag on the prequels, rag on the Ewoks, tell Misa Jar Jar jokes all you want, but at least do it well. This was a travesty. The campy quest titles had metastasized and become Stage 4, or maybe Episode 4, cancer inside the game itself. And now I was looking at a goddamn cheese fest. The game was going to force me to go save Ilaria inside a campy Star Wars parody.
"Chewie here tells me you're looking for a ship," the pilot repeated.
Old-style NPC. He had a limited range of responses, and he would probably repeat them ad nauseam unless I gave him something else to work with. Actually, I take that back. He would repeat them ad infinitum. Ad nauseam meant to the point of nausea, and I was already nauseated.
Let's get this over with.
How much? I'm the captain of...
A bad version of the Millennium Falcon. Yeah, how much? The NPC looked fairly pissed off for a mindless automaton.
The Century Chicken Hawk.
Of course it was. They couldn't even give it a cool bird name, like Osprey or an eagle. Not even a hawk. It had to be a chicken hawk. I expected Foghorn Leghorn to come around the corner any second.
Boy, I say, boy!
It's the ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. I got it. How much? The Kessel Run, the NPC snapped.
Okay, that was kind of funny. Sort of.
Look, I need to track down a pirate named Tarka.
I've outrun
Imperial starships. How much?
Airships. And not
the local bulk cruisers, mind you. You're talking about the big Corellian ships, and yes, that's fast enough for me. Want to know the cargo? It's me and the imp. Some kind of local trouble? Yes. And we want to avoid Imperial entanglements, and that's the trick, isn't it? I'm sure it's going to cost me something extra. Now how much?
The pilot stared daggers at me.
10 gold in advance.
I paused.
No, they wouldn't.
I pulled up the computer window for the contents of my bag. 2 gold, 25 silver, and assorted bronze.
Crap.
There are no coincidences in the game. The game had set me up from the beginning for what came next. Game, set, match.
Well played, assholes.
I can give you 2 gold in advance, I sighed, paraphrasing Obi-Wan's famous counterbid in the cantina. Plus 15 when we reached Tarka the pirate. I had no idea how I was going to get 15 gold, but I supposed I could figure that out. A window popped up. I've got a bad feeling about this.
Oh no, you didn't, you bastards.
Book passage with Hark Silo and First Mate Shu Haka on the Century Chickenhawk to go find Ilaria. XP 1000. Cost 2 gold.
I even had to pay to be part of this bullshit.
But there was no use fighting it. I just surrendered and hit accept.
17, huh? Hark grinned. Okay, you've got yourself a ship. Docking bay.
94, cool, we'll be there, I said, and got up.
Don't forget your imp.
Huh? Oh. Stig was still lying face down on the mushroom floor. Stig? He just lay there. I prodded him lightly with my toe.
Stig?
No answer. I sighed, heaved him up over my shoulder, turned back to face my local dinner theater Star Wars characters, and tried to look dignified. I failed.
It's pretty hard to look dignified with a drunk imp slung over your shoulder.
See you in 30 minutes, I said, and walked out of the bar. I swear to God, if I ever cornered Other World's writing staff, I was going to give them a piece of my mind. Mark my words. Sorry, that was bad.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.